Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today I'm welcoming back Greg Oppenheimer. We're going to talk about his play, and we're also going to talk about the ability to download the radio broadcast. We'll be going into that a little later, but I'm really excited. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Sherry. Glad to be here.
I'm so happy to have you here. I'm so happy for you. The reviews for the play are amazing. Did you enjoy being the author? Did they call you on stage saying bravo, bravo, and everything?
they recognized things. I sat in the back row most nights, and I just had a ball. It was one of my favorite weeks ever. Just immersing myself in that, and a lot of people, a lot of laughs. Great. There's nothing like sitting in the back of a theater full of people laughing uproariously at a line you've written.
Yeah. Oh, that must be so cool. Just hearing the laughter to everything you wrote. That's just so great.
The amazing thing to me was there's one line in every performance, and I was at every performance, but every performance it got a laugh, and I didn't write it as a laugh line. And so it was like, okay, that's nice. I wonder why they're laughing. There's the place where they say, do you remember that screening we had last week of Vitamin to Vegemin? And as soon as they say Vitamin to Vegemin, the whole place cracks up. And I,
because
like,
everybody knows it. That's why.
I know. But do you expect I didn't expect a whole crowd of people to laugh just at the word, but they did. And it was like clockwork every time. Like, here we go again. So that was a lot of fun.
That's cool. I guess it's just the laughter of recognition because everybody knows what that is.
Yeah.
Well, everybody who's seen, I can't think of anybody who hasn't seen I Love Lucy, but I guess there are some very poor people who've never seen it, and I feel so sorry for them. I have listened. There's a free download of the play for just a week. You can't download it into. Okay, go ahead.
This Thursday, it's still going to be there, but sometime Friday they're taking it down, and after that it'll cost, I guess, $4.99. But until at least through Thursday midnight, it'll be free. And it's at latw.org.
It's worth it. It's delightful, really. It's such a fun thing. I listened to it on Sunday, and I was here. I was by myself, and I'm laughing my head off.
Good. Yeah, everybody had a great time. And actually, it was fun. I just went to the theater company's next production, which was a drama, Little Foxes. On Saturday, and several people came up to me and said how much they enjoyed the last play. They recognized me from when I was there before, and that felt really good.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing. This is like the third. Because you did a little bit of I Love Lucy as the play in the back of your book, and then you did a broadcast. Was it a broadcast or was it a play when you did the second thing?
The first thing I ever did was the My Favorite Husband recreation 18 years ago with LA Theater Works. But I didn't write that. That was my father's writing, and it was with Mary Lou Henner as Lucy. And then in 2011, I did the play that I wrote for Lucy's 100th birthday in Jamestown, which is where she's born, for their comedy festival. And we produced it there, and it was on Sirius XM. But that was very short. That was like 30 minutes long. And it was just like act one of this and different. Not as good, but it was fun. And then I did another version of that same thing at the Motion Picture television fund country house, retirement home in Woodland Hills with a really good cast. And, William S. Paley was Dick Van Patten. And Betty Garrett was played by Janet Waldo, who's the voice of Judy Jetson.
Wow.
And Phil Proctor played Des Arnaz and Walter Winchell, who's not in my play now, but was at the time. And then I've been doing readings around town. And then this. So it's going. It's been going on for 7 years working on this play. And it's nice to have it come to fruition and be well received.
Yeah. Is it going to go to other theaters? Are you in talks?
I'm planning to do something next March in Beverly Hills as a benefit for the Actors Fund, hopefully with the same cast, one night only. And so when that gets firmed up, I'll let people know. And then I'm hoping it would be nice if it toured, but that won't happen anytime soon because tours have to plan them like 18 months or so in advance because theaters book early. So that won't be for a while, but I'm working on it.
That's so cool, though. I really find it fascinating the way you went from part to part. I mean, I know you said the first part was your dad's, and then but the rest of it was inspired by what your dad did anyway, because your dad's in the play.
Yeah, that was very interesting, talking with the guy who's playing my father. With Seamus, who I watch on Castle all the time. He was one of the stars of the TV series Castle. So I knew him well, and I'd seen him on the stage, too. So to have a Jewish writer played by a guy named Seamus was interesting. He did a really good job.
No, I really thought the whole thing was I love one of my favorite lines from your dad was when they said it was a piece of crap, or I don't remember exactly, and he goes, "Oh well, thank you." Even though it wasn't like laughed crazy. No, it's just like it wasn't like a hard laugh line, but it was just the way he said it that he
threw
it.
As the head of programming, CBS says this is the worst thing I've ever seen, and Dad says, "Well, you're tops in my book too, Hubble."
That's it. I loved it. I started laughing my head off. I was like, "You tell him."
And then later, Hubble Robinson claims he liked it from the first moment he ever saw it.
Sort of typical studio chief.
I mean, there was so much. There's like, "Oh well, he must have made that up for the play, or just to get a laugh or something." But everything in there it really happened. So he really. Claimed, that he loved it from the start and all that. Lucy really did smoke Chesterfields, and they had to, hide it by putting them in Philip Morris packs and all that crazy stuff.
That was one of the lines. I don't know if your dad wrote it. She's trying to think of a name for their child.
Oh, Philip.
And Philip and Morris.
Philip if it's a boy, Morris if it's a girl, yeah. Yeah, that's in the same paragraph where they've decided on Gregory if it's a boy, Joanne if it's a girl. That's me and my sister.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Gregory I can figure, but I didn't know your sister's name. Oh, that's so cute.
They worked everybody in there. In that same show, she says, we couldn't do that to little Bob or Madeline.
Oh, that's true. That I picked up, yeah.
Yeah.
How many names did they come up with for that episode?
And then, of course, the payoff is she says, "No, this is serious. I want our baby's name to be unique, euphonious." And she says,
"That's
okay,
good.
Unique if it's a boy, euphonious if it's a girl."
Those aren't names, they're words. It was so funny. I was wondering for that one, was that your dad who wrote that episode?
Well, the three of them wrote every episode, Bob and Madeline and my father. And the way it would work is on Monday, they would basically go in my dad's office and lock the door, and my dad wouldn't let them out until they had the show all plotted and you know, no phone calls, nothing. And they had, you know, this all the plot points in the show outlined from, you know, how it began, you know, beginning, middle, end, and how the plot went. And then they would write up an outline, and Merce would type it up. And then Bob and Madeline would go off, and while my dad worked on his other duties as producer, because he was had to supervise the editing and music and everything, which Bob and Madeline weren't involved in. And they would write up a first draft. They would give it back to him, and he would mark it up in pencil and give it back to them. Then a couple of days later, they'd give him a second draft, and then it would never go back to them. He would work on it, and then he'd dictate the whole thing from start to finish, with their draft and his notes on it, and that would go into Mimeo. And then the following Monday, everybody would see it for the first time. Lucy and Desi had no involvement at all, and nobody saw that draft until it came out.
So, we better tell everybody. Mimeo is what came before Xerox. It was a way to make copies. for the younger people who've never heard of the word, that's
younger people
that
don't know
is.
What word Xerox is. What are you talking about?
Well, that's true. Download printer.
<Yes. laughs> It's how you printed copies of something is you would actually use the typewriter to cut little stencils in a sheet that then you would put on a drum, and ink would go through the little holes that the typewriter made in it and run it off like a printing press.
Yes, a typewriter is the predecessor of a computer.
Yes. And this is way off subject, but do you know why the computer keyboards and typewriter keyboards are arranged the way they are with Q-W-E-R-T-Y-U-O-I-P or whatever?
They told us when I took my typing class when I was in junior high school, but I don't remember, to be honest. Why? Because I always thought it was weird.
You'd think it would be, it would, of course, make sense to arrange so you could type as fast as possible, right, and as easy as possible. But if that were the case, your right index finger would be at rest on the letter E, because that's the most commonly used letter. But instead, that's your middle finger on your left hand and up a row. And so what happened was the first arrangement was done, to make it as easy as possible. But the old mechanical typewriters, the letters were on the end of these things that went up when you hit the keys, and they got jammed if you type too fast. So they just kept rearranging the letters to slow people down until they slowed it down so much that you couldn't jam it. And so it's really...
Really?
We're still using the typewriter or keyboard arrangement on computers that were designed to be as hard as possible to type.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that. That's interesting. I mean, I think they told us that in my typing class, but she told us something, but I didn't know that was to make it slow down so they wouldn't jam up the typewriter. I remember my dad's portable typewriter, which was like an old-fashioned, he had that for years. I mean, that was his one, that was, I still have it in storage. I mean, it's like this precious thing to my dad that he kept it from like the late 40s, early 50s. I don't remember when he got it.
Remember the brand?
Yeah.
What was it?
I'm trying to think. I mean, hold on.
Smith Corona? Underwood?
Underwood.
Yeah.
Underwood.
It's one of the moguls.
Loves that typewriter.
The Hollywood studio moguls. I think it was Sam Goldwyn, maybe somebody else. But he was referred to writers as schmucks with Underwoods.
He would. Oh my God. But I just remember when I was young, I had to use a typewriter to type up my reports for high school and junior high school. And I also used it for my stories when I started writing my stories. And that is just too heavy for a girl. I mean, those typewriters were so hard to type. I would be breaking my nails. I would be hurting my pinkies. It was like my
dad
finally got.
That's why the electric typewriter was invented.
He bought me an electric typewriter when I was in high school. Well, what do they call it? Do they call them? They don't exist anymore. It was sort of like a transition typewriter between the typewriter and the computer.
Brother.
But it was a brother, but there's a name for it. It's like
word processor.
Word processor. He bought me a word processor when I was a senior in high school because I had so many papers to write and I was really hurting my fingers.
As Cuisinart never made one.
Yeah, it would be appropriate.
You put the words in and it comes out all blended together.
Yeah, exactly. I like that. That's a good line. You should put that in your next script. We were talking before the show about some of the scenes from your play, and one of the ones you told me about, I just loved. Could you tell the audience about that, please?
Betty? Yeah. There's a scene, the opening scene of the play. They're just finishing recording My Favorite Husband, or actually broadcasting My Favorite Husband, because then it was live. As it finishes, Betty Garrett, the actress, calls Lucy from the audience. She she goes up on the stage, and she tells Lucy that she's pregnant. And Lucy says, "You lucky bum, you know, we're trying." And she says to Lucy, "Put your feet up against the wall afterwards. It worked for us." Because she and her husband. And, you know, Lucy laughs at that, but she'll try it. That conversation really happened, but it didn't happen in the studio. It happened on the street. They happened to pull up next to each other when they were both driving down the street in Hollywood. And so they stopped at a stoplight, and they had the conversation loudly across, you know, from one car to the next, which is why someone heard it, and that's how the story got out. So I incorporated it into the play, but I had it happen where the play took place as opposed to out on the street.
I just think I can just picture that, because I've actually seen people do that. Like they would stop traffic to have a conversation, yelling through the windows, and like, especially in a nice sunny day here in California, you see that a lot. So it's quite, you can believe it if you live here, especially that happens. So that's why I start laughing hysterically. What's your favorite? I mean, I'm sure the whole play is your favorite, but do you have a favorite scene in the play?
Well, yes. If I had to pick a scene, it's a pretty long scene, but it's a scene where Dad and Desi have to talk. Bigwig. Letting pregnancy shows on the show. Where Lucy's pregnant, Lucy Ricardo is pregnant, and of course the CBS didn't want to do that, and it goes on for a long time. But I think that scene is better than anything else.
I love the whole thing, but yeah, I love that scene. I love that. I love the religious representatives all saying, "What's wrong with the word pregnant?"
But I also like the fact that it's a long scene, but in the middle of it, you go into an actual episode of I Love Lucy itself.
Yeah, I know, and I was kind of comparing it because they showed it today.
Yeah. But you get to see them actually act out different versions of the same scene that people know. So I thought I find that interesting. It's sort of like that what we were talking about was the movie Stranger Than Fiction, where you know, he's describing it, and as he's talking, all of a sudden the characters come to life.
I think that's one of the fun thing as a writer is watching your characters come to life. It's just like this weird, it's just strange because it comes from your mind, your imagination, you made it up. Your stuff is real because it happened, but when I write a radio play, it's all made up. I mean, my stuff isn't real life. So when people are performing it and bringing it to life, it's like, whoa. I mean, do you feel that way, even though it really happened?
Yeah, particularly on the ones where I used a little bit of, sorry about that, a little artistic license. I know it happened, but I don't know the exact words they use, so I have to make it up. So I tried to make it true to, you know, how I knew he talked and everything, but. So I get a kick out of, you know, seeing them say those lines, and I say, oh, this is something I made up, and they're up doing it. It's great.
It's really kind of cool. It's like, I don't know, it's magic to me. It really is. It's the talent of the actor and stuff, too, but it is magic in a way.
Yeah. I agree.
Now, you... I mean, of course you knew your dad, but you knew Lucy and you knew Desi and you knew everybody involved in the show, William Frawley and all those people. What would be the reaction of this, do you think? Do you think they would have one? They must have something. But what do you think they would think of it?
I think they would like it. I think everybody comes off pretty well. There really isn't a heavy in it. I mean, maybe Hubble Robinson a little bit, but I wouldn't really care what he says about
it. No. I meant people you knew and loved, like, you know, Lucy and people like that.
Well, I think I'll love it. I think my dad would love it, too. Because what I don't think she would... love is all these TV movies that they keep doing about Lucy and Desi because they're all so grim.
And they're horrible. I don't care, even if it's the greatest actors, they're just all, there's none of the good side, all of the bad side. I hate them. I only watched one of them, and then I read what the thing was about the other one, and I won't watch it. Why? That's my question. Why? There's no reason for it.
I don't know. And they don't, they just skip all the really good stories that you could tell. But I think they're looking for drama. But it's not true because everybody loved everybody on that show. I mean, when Ethel and Fred didn't love each other, but.
Yeah.
They all, even though they didn't love each other, they all had a good time doing the show, and they all loved going to work, and they loved the work they did.
But even though Bill Frawley and Vivian Vance didn't like each other, they were professionals. They did their jobs.
Oh, yeah, you never saw it. You never saw it. That's why it's such a surprise to everybody, because... because they weren't the most lovey-dovey couple, but you certainly didn't get impression that he meant it when he bad-mouthed her on the show.
No, not at all.
My favorite line ever on the show was when the boys are doing the housework and the girls go to the candy factory and Fred comes out. Or Ricky comes out of the kitchen and says, "Say, Fred, what do you know about anything about rice?" And Fred says, "Only that I had it thrown at me one of the darkest days of my life."
Yeah.
It's just a very funny line.
It is a very funny line. That's actually, I love that episode. I don't even know. I guess my favorite. Yours is the one with Bill Holden, right?
Yeah. I had to pick one.
Yours. I'm trying to think if I have a... I love all of them, so it's really hard for me to pick one. And I watch them quite often. I guess when the one I just saw, when Lucy tells Ricky that she's pregnant, I just, the sweetness of it, the love that is sparkling in their eyes, and you know it's real. And it's just, because she's really pregnant. And now that I've read your book and I found out that he forgot what he was doing because he was so over the moon about it. That
and you know who,
it
you
even,
know who yells, sing the baby song, sing the baby song?
No,
it's
who?
It's the band.
I mean, I knew the band. I was like, did someone start it in the band saying that, or was it everybody?
It was just several people in the band reminding Ricky, reminding Desi, you know, what he's supposed to do next because he forgot.
Because I thought maybe it was Marco or somebody who knew him really well saying, come on.
Well, it didn't sound like Marco. Marco has quite an accent, so.
Yeah, okay.
But it was spontaneous, and it was such a real moment, and they thought they were going to have to redo it. You know, when Billy Asher, the director, stood up after they did that scene in tears, and it did have mess-ups, and they had to remind him what to do, and he messed up the lyrics. And he says, okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have to do that. But we're going to take that scene again. And the whole audience rose up and said, no! And they didn't.
Because who cares, really?
Well,
maybe the lyricists cared, but, I mean, that the point of it was is that it was two people in love. It was obvious.
Well, they, you know, in the moment, though, they just wanted to have it. They weren't saying, well, we can't possibly use that one. They were thinking, okay, well, that had some problems. Maybe we ought to get, just for safety, it's called a safety, you know, just get a safe, extra take so they have it. But one of my favorite stories is, it has nothing to do with Lucy, but, you know, Lucy had a no-retake policy,
mm-hmm.
partly because they couldn't afford the film. For a second take, just, you know, three cameras going, it costs a lot of money, and film was a big part of it. Plus, they wanted to get it over faster, they'd have to pay people more. But, you know the movie Ocean's 11?
Yeah.
The first one with Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack.
Yeah, I remember it.
They shot that movie while they were all performing in Vegas. And they'd start shooting at 2 a.m. or 2:30 a.m. You know, after they finished their gigs, their acts, and they would shoot, and they would keep going until, you know, past dawn for the daylight shows, scenes, and they could set up anyway. There was no traffic or anything at 6 a.m. You know, everything was one take, and they had a director. But really, the guy in charge was Sinatra, and
mm-hmm.
he just wanted to get done with it and go home, go back to sleep. And they always did one take, and then once the director said, you know, Frank, I think I'd like a second take of that scene. And Sinatra just turns to him and says, print that one twice.
Yeah, I've read that about him, that he didn't like to rehearse, he didn't like to do retakes. Yeah, I read that about him.
This is way off subject, but if we're talking about Sinatra, I have to tell you one of my favorite stories about him, which I'm sure people haven't heard. There's a friend of mine, an actor I work with a lot, this guy named Stuffy Singer, who was a child actor. In the very last part of radio, and then he was on Burns and Allen and Jack Benny on TV as a child. He was voice of two of the Lost Boys in Disney's Peter Pan. Anyway, but then he grew a little older and stopped acting. He became an athlete, baseball player in school, and then in college he got into handball, which four-wall handball used to be a very big deal. And he was a champion. Anyway, so it's 1971, and he's now like a financial advisor or something, and I don't know what industry he was working in at the time, but he had been away from show business for a while. But he had this guy who was his mentor who was still in show business called him in 71 and said, Duffy, the Muhammad Ali Frazier heavyweight championship is going to be, next week. How would you like tickets? And they were impossible to come by. And it was a huge deal. And Safi said, oh, I love it. That's great. He says, well, tell you what, come by my office the day before because Burt Lancaster is going to be doing color commentary, and I'm going to screen some old movie fight movies for newsreels and stuff for Burt, and so he can take notes and be up on the history, and I know you love that stuff, so come by my office and you can watch them too. And he says, great. So Duffy arrives at this guy's office. Burt Lancaster's already there watching the films are going on. And so Duffy introduces Duffy to Burt Lancaster. excuse me. He sits and watches the movies. 30 minutes go by, knock on the office door, and Duffy's friend says, come in. And the door opens and it's Alan King, who was a big comedian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I saw him on stage.
Yeah. So he says hello to Burt and Duffy's friend. Everybody's ignoring Duffy, sitting in the back just minding his own business. Alan King sits and watches the fights with Burt Lancaster. Duffy's friend's at his desk doing some work. Pardon me. 15 minutes later, knock on the door again. Duffy's friend says, come in, Frank Sinatra. He comes in, he and Burt Lancaster and Alan King say hi, and they sit together, and Duffy's friend goes back to work. Gets to be around noon, Duffy's friend says, why don't we go downstairs and get something to eat at the Stage Deli? And everybody says, it's great. So they're heading out the door, phone rings, Duffy's friend says, I have to take this, get a table, I'll be down to join you. So they're going down the stairs, Duffy's a few steps behind Burt Lancaster, Alan King, and Frank Sinatra, but they go down to Stage Deli. They get a table. Stuffy's at one end. There's an empty seat, and the three of them are huddled talking. Stuffy looks across the restaurant, and there's a guy way at the other end of the restaurant standing up and spies their table, and eyes light up. I'm striding over to their table and stands there and says, Mr. Singer, you probably don't remember me, but I'm the athletic director at South Bend High School in South Bend, Indiana. A few years back, you came by and did a handball demonstration that was just terrific. Could I get your autograph? He's not used to giving autographs. The other guys are just sort of staring, and he says, sure. So he gives him his autograph, and the guy turns and leaves this restaurant. So Burt Lancaster, Alan King, and Frank Sinatra are sitting there sort of staring. It's Stuffy at the other end of the table, and after a few seconds, Sinatra turns to Burt Lancaster and says, guess that's what happens when you're really famous.
Oh, that's adorable. Who told you that story?
Stuffy.
Stuffy did. Oh, that's a great story. That is so great.
I'm directing Stuffy in something on November 3rd in Costa Mesa. I'm going to bring a bunch of people in.
No, I'm just repeating what you said. You're going to be doing a show in Costa Mesa?
Yeah, I'm at the old Spurdivac Old Time Radio Convention at the Crown Plaza in Costa Mesa. Easy Aces and Burns and Allen.
Cool.
With Phil Proctor's always been one of my comedy idols. You ever Firesign Theater?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's super. That's really cool.
And Alison Arngrim from Little House on the Prairie. She was the bitch. Little House on the Prairie. Yeah. She wrote a book
There's
called...
There's no other way to describe her, yeah.
Her book is called... Her memoir is called Confessions of a Prairie Bitch.
Is that open to the public? The show you're going
you
to?
Have to
I mean, the convention?
You have to buy tickets to the convention and be there all day. But if anybody is interested, it's spurdvac.com. SPERDVAC, just like it sounds, SPERDVAC. It stands for the Society to Preserve and Encourage Radio Drama, Variety, and Comedy. But they're called SPERDVAC.
Cool. I didn't even know that existed. That's really cool.
Yeah. Used to be, they had all the old-time radio stars were members and came and formed, and but now it's just the only people still alive are the child actors. And we have several of them. We have Margaret O'Brien is doing a suspense. You know Margaret O'Brien from Meet Me in St. Louis.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I who else I got. Greg Berger, who's the voice of Odie, Garfield and Friends, Odie the dog, and Transformers and a whole bunch of other things. And Allison Arngrim is playing Gracie Allen. And it'll be a lot of fun.
And who's playing George?
Greg Berger. Playing,
cool.
Playing George. The guy who plays the voice of the dog. He's very versatile.
Yeah. From playing
his
a puppy
wife,
dog to playing a George.
His wife, Dora Pearson, is his wife, and she's going to sing. She was the lead female vocalist for Sha-na-na.
Wow. That's fun. That is fun. And that's this weekend?
November 3rd.
November, okay. Because who knows, maybe I'll go to that. we don't have a lot of time. Could you tell them about where they can hear your play and buy it for, because it's mostly on Amazon? Is that where it is?
You can buy it on Amazon. You can buy it on Amazon. I don't know if you can download it on Amazon, but Audible. Yeah, you can get it on Audible or on Amazon or latw.org is the easiest place to buy it. Through Thursday it's free to stream. If you want to buy it and have it on your computer and own it, it's $4.99, and that'll be available on latw.org forever. It's easy to find it, latw.org, and search I Love Lucy. Right now it's on the homepage.
And the name of the play is called I Love Lucy, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Sitcom.
Yes.
And
how did you like the
name? I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved the whole play.
Doug Walter, who did a great job on the music, you know, that opening thing where Desi says, okay, cue my orchestra, and we had to come up with something that sounded like Desi Arnaz's orchestra playing something and that, you know, that he would play. So Doug came up with something original because we didn't want to clear any copyrighted music.
Yeah, exactly. It was all Latin, right?
What?
Some of the beat of the music was like a Latin beat, like Desi did.
That piece was, yes. The rest of it was more like some of the sound. I told him, make everything sound like it's Wilbur Hatch arrangement, Wilbur Hatch's orchestra, played by the Desi Arnaz Orchestra, like the transitional music they had in I Love Lucy. Without a laugh track. I guess it had a laugh track because you heard the audience laughing, but... I wanted it to feel like an episode of I Love Lucy, as opposed to feel like a play.
I saw an interview on YouTube with Desi, and that's one of the funny things he said, because he was talking about, you know, about the live audience and everything. He says, I can hear them when I watch other sitcoms. I can actually pick out my ex-mother-in-law and things like that. Because he's talking about how Lucy's mother's laugh was so distinctive, which I already knew.
that's true. I can't remember Charlie's last name, but they got Charlie Douglas, who invented the laugh track machine. And the first thing he loaded it up with was I Love Lucy laughs. He was at CBS. So that's why you heard people from the Lucy audience on other shows. But they never used a laugh track on I Love Lucy. They used, here's someone laughing.
Live audience, right.
And it's not just a live audience. It's the first take. And so the people are laughing. And the reason it's so great laughter is because they're hearing it for the very first time.
I can actually hear Desi sometimes when he's off camera.
He also has a
at least I think so. I think it's him, but it sounds like his laugh.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, he's got a distinctive laugh, and you can hear him. There's several places where it's definitely Desi.
Yeah, Dee Dee and Desi are the two I know I hear.
I think I heard my aunt once that I recognized, but I can't remember where.
Really? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You know, it's really funny. My parents, my dad was working at one of the plants in downtown L.A. So he was on the shift where the swing shift. So when he came home, it was like morning. And so he would take my mom out shopping and stuff that she needed. And then for an evening, because they didn't have a lot of money, they would go see sitcoms. And one of the sitcoms they went to see a lot was I Love Lucy. So every time I see on Instagram or YouTube, like the pictures of the audience, I'm like looking really close trying to find my parents because I know they're there somewhere.
I've got one picture. There's a pretty picture. It's in, not in my book, but it's in, maybe it is, where Milton Bio and like the Arthur, the guy from Philip Morris are being led to their seats in the audience. And but in the front row is my Uncle Jack and my Uncle Goody and my cousin Barry. And I can recognize that, all these people from my family. And,
oh, that's so cool. The thing is that everybody dressed so much alike in the 50s. It's so hard. You know, they're all wearing the same suit. They're all wearing the same tie in the same style tie, and I figured my dad's taller, so I'd notice him first.
Yeah.
So,
well, the weird thing,
they all look alike.
Strangest thing, and this won't mean anything to anybody but me, but if you go to in Jamestown, one of the famous pictures of it's taken from the soundstage, like from the point of view of the actor, and you're looking at see the three cameras, and Carl Freund, the cinematographer, is standing next to one of them, and then you see the bleachers behind them and people sitting in the bleachers, and then up at the top of the bleachers is the booth, and you can see my dad standing in the booth and everything, and it's a very nice picture of the whole setup there from the point of view of taken from the set as opposed to taken from the other direction. And in the first row of the audience is a guy who's maybe 16, 18 years old, young guy.
Mm-hmm.
He looks exactly like me when I was 18. I mean, if you show me that picture out of context, oh, yeah, that's me. It's uncanny. And of course, at the time, I was 1 year old.
You were a baby.
So, yes. It's very bizarre.
You were like, what, 8, 9 years old? You were a kid.
I was younger than that. When this picture was taken, I was less than a year old.
Oh, okay, so that was taken at the very beginning, before when it first started, okay.
Late 51, I think.
Oh, yeah, so you were an infant.
Yeah, well, it's definitely not me. I mean, that's just... I didn't,
maybe,
the first time I went...
Is it a relative?
No.
Could it be,
no.
Like, a cousin or somebody?
I have no idea who it is, just somebody who happened to look exactly like I would end up looking.
That is bizarre. That is so bizarre.
I'm sorry. Tell you a picture of me as an 18-year-old and that shot too, if I can find it.
Maybe Greg, you were a time traveler, and you don't know it.
Yeah, I'm gonna do.
And you
I'm
went
gonna do
back
a little.
And.
I'm going to do a little time travel. I won't explain any more than that, but I'm going to do a little time travel thing at the Costa Mesa thing. That's right up.
Oh, you are?
That's right.
I love time travel.
You'll see.
It's like one of my favorite things. I got to go see this thing.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite things. I love time travel.
Have you seen the movie? Have you seen the movie About Time?
About Time.
It's by the same guy who did Love Actually.
Okay. No, I haven't seen that. I seen Love Actually, but I didn't see About Time. That's Richard Curtis, right?
Yes. Oh, you have to see Love. You have to see About Time. If you like Love Actually and you like time travel, you will love this.
Okay, I've never heard of that one, and I love time travel. I mean, I've pretty much seen every time travel movie I can. Is that like on film or is it a TV show?
It's a movie starring Bill Nye. And Rachel McAdams, and the guy who played the guy in Ireland in the movie Brooklyn, the guy in Ireland that she wanted to marry her.
Tell me later, but I want to know what it's about. Because heard of it.
You got to go see it or stream it.
Yeah, I'll rent it. Okay, we're coming to the end. I want, if you have like a favorite story you want to tell, now's the time. that we haven't heard.
Has to have something to do with I Love Lucy.
Whatever one you want, but whatever kind of story, I don't care. I'm open.
I think of it. All right, give it a minute. I know. I saw a funny sign the other day. I'm sure it was a mistake. It was on a bakery, and it said, "Wedding cakes for all occasions." I think it was supposed to say wedding cakes, and then the second line was supposed to say cakes for all occasions, and the sign painter got confused.
But they hung it. Or was it on a billboard?
No, it was on the window.
It was on the window. Okay, so they hung it up. Oh, that's cute. Anyway, I want to thank you for coming on the show. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for taking the time.
You're welcome. I'm glad you enjoyed the play.
Oh, I did. And anybody, go to LAT. It's right on the front. There's like a little arrow. Just press the arrow, and it'll just do the whole play for you. You'll just sit back and enjoy.
Good. Thank you.
It's really great. Thank you, Greg.
Bye.
And thank you for chatting with Sherry.